The Royal Albert Hall for this evening's prom. It's presented by Petroc Trelawney.
Good evening to you. This is the 116th season of the BBC Proms, and tonight the venerable festival welcomes an orchestra that is just 2 years its junior, the Czech Philharmonic. Its first concert took place at the Rudolfinum in Prague on January the 4th, 1896, conducted by Antonín Dvořák. Well, tonight's concert's going to open and close with Dvořák, the Eighth Symphony later, the Carnival Overture in just a few seconds. It's an extended three-parter this evening, planned to be a real showcase for repertoire that's absolutely in the blood of the Czech Phil. It was Václav Talek who first introduced Martinů's music to the orchestra in the 1920s. Tonight we'll hear the Fantaisie Symphonique, also known as the Sixth Symphony, along with Janáček's fiercely patriotic Ballad of Blanik. Right in the middle of the concert, we break from Central Europe and look to Norway as Lars Vogt plays Grieg's Piano Concerto. While conducting tonight, a man who is leading four proms this evening, Sir John Eliot Gardner, a musician we perhaps too easily associate exclusively with the British early music revival. In fact, he regularly conducts the great European orchestras, Berlin, Vienna, the Concertgebouw in Amsterdam, and the Czech Philharmonic, who he's been working with for more than a decade. So it's Dvořák to start this evening, writing when he was 50 and had become internationally famous, so much so that he'd been approached to go to America to become director at the new National Conservatoire in New York. It was a tempting offer, and one that he ultimately accepted, but it took him some months to negotiate a contract, during which time he wrote three overtures, which he called Nature, Life and Love. Later he gave them individual names. The second became the Carnival Overture. John Eliot Gardner makes his way onto the platform to conduct the Czech Philharmonic here at the BBC Proms. Dvořák's Carnival Overture, the Czech Philharmonic, conducted at the Proms by John Elliott Gardner. Work that Dvořák conducted at a farewell concert at the National Theatre in Prague immediately before he set sail to America. Well, one of the great highlights of Jerzy Bielochlawek's time as chief conductor of the BBC Symphony has been hearing his interpretations of Bohuslav Martinů's music, a Czech maestro leading his British players. Tonight the tables are turned as John Elliott Gardner conducts the Czech Phil in Martinů's Sixth Symphony, also known as the Fantaisie Symphonique, written in the early 1950s and inspired by his own opera, Giulietta. Martinů's symphonies are the work of the New World. He left Prague for Paris in the 1920s and then fled the French capital in 1940 for the US. His first five symphonies were written during the Second World War, the last one composed as he contemplated a return to Prague, a move that never happened. John Elliott Gardner.
Martinů, who had this tragic life, really, you know, becoming a refugee and going off to Paris and sleeping on park benches, and then only at the last moment catching a boat before the Second World War broke out to New York, and he didn't speak a word of English. And then just before he wrote this symphony, he had this horrendous accident when he fell off a balcony and cracked his skull, and he had serious problems with his hearing and his whole mental equilibrium for some while after that. And I feel you can hear that in this symphony, that the use of very close intervals, semitones, almost microtones that he uses, it's like a sort of background tinnitus almost in his ear, very painful and anguished.
Well, the Sixth Symphony was commissioned by Charles Munch, his old friend from Paris days, who was by then running the Boston Symphony Orchestra. The work was to celebrate the orchestra's 75th birthday season in 1955. Martinů told his biographer he created a work practically without form, but something, he said, holds it together. I don't know what it is, but it has a single line, and I've expressed something in it. So here comes John Elliott Gardner, wending his way through the players of the Czech Philharmonic to conduct Martinů's Fantaisie Symphonique, his symphony number 6.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you. Fantaisie Symphonique, the Symphony No. 6 of Boguslav Martinu. Czech Philharmonic, John Elliott Gardner conducting. Written in New York in the very early 50s, revised in Paris in 1953, when Martinu abandoned his initial plan to call it a new fantastic symphony with its clear reference to Berlioz. Premiered then by the Boston Symphony in 1955. Martinu was briefly a member of tonight's orchestra, the Czech Philharmonic. He played second violin. He was employed by the orchestra not long after being thrown out of the Prague Conservatoire, accused of incorrigible negligence. Went to Paris soon after, where he studied with Albert Roussel. Then on to America. After the war, he lived in the States, France, Italy, Switzerland, but never made it back to Czechoslovakia. Taught composition while in America. One of his students was Burt Bacharach. The long journey made by a composer born high up in a church tower in a village on the borders of Bohemia and Moravia. Went to America where he wrote his symphonies, died in Switzerland in 1959. Well, another symphony still to come this Sunday night, Dvorak's 8th symphony. That's well over an hour away, though. Janáček's Ballad of Blanik as well. And after the first interval, Lars Vogt will be on stage to play Grieg's Piano Concerto. That's in 20 minutes' time, during which we enjoy a pluvial celebration with the poet Peter Didsbury. Rain.
A Saturday lunchtime restaurant down a side street in the rain. We're the only customers. Against the far wall, waiters stand with tired eyes, eyes that have seen bad behaviour the evening before. It's quiet. Something falls in the kitchen. There's a cry from the street. Raindrops sluice the half-curtained windows. In the distance, an occasional car busily unzips the wet roads. Oh, if only this were true, because what I'm actually doing is sitting at my desk on a sunny Tuesday morning, constricting the scene from both memory and desire. A strong word, but in dry seasons, the true pluviophile must resort to remembered or imagined delights. To such as we, even the dream of rainfall is enough to set the endorphins flowing, invoke all the agencies that pertain to profound well-being. If 'twere true, 'twere paradise. As it is, it's paradise enow. To put it quite simply, rain makes me happy. I'm told it's because of negative ions and the regulation of serotonin levels. This may well be so. Personally, I prefer to think in older and less unforgiving terms. Rainfall as channel of discourse between earth and heaven. Rain as gracious invitation to shelter. A curtain of rain advancing in front of the lightning. Earth, air, water, fire. I've been told it's unusual too, though I take leave to doubt this, and perhaps what was meant was the intensity, not the fact, of my affections. Shopkeepers and their customers grumble loudly on rainy days, but look, they're wreathed in smiles. You know the scene. Miserable weather, they chorus as the shop bell clangs behind you, but rubbing their hands in glee all the while, in obvious enjoyment. I usually reply with an understated, I rather like it, actually. Rarely does anyone agree outright with me, though. The best I can hope for is a grudging, well, the garden's needed it. Maybe I'm wrong, and all these smiling faces are genuinely expressive of a real hatred of rain. Maybe all this evident good humour is simply a kind of wartime spirit in the face of a wet morning. And yet, I can't believe it. I know there are other pluviophiles out there. I've met them. Could it be that while there are indeed millions, most are in self-denial? Or perhaps the majority is secretive by nature? Not that I fall into that category myself. Given the opportunity, as I have been, I'll proclaim my love of rainfall, my interest in all its manifestations, to anyone who'll listen whenever occasion arises. So when did it start, this deeply embedded amour? I don't really know. I certainly don't have any of those improbably early memories so beloved of the biographer. I don't recall the sound of April showers on the canopy and apron of my late 1940s cream-coloured coach-built pram. There does not remain with me, potent to this day, any garden epiphany beneath a wet laburnum tree, so crucial to my later becoming a poet. In fact, it seems to me now as if my childhood was singularly devoid of rainfall, which it wasn't, of course. It's just that weather of any kind, unless in some way particularly pertinent or exceptional, seems to be quite unimportant to the memory-forming process. Most of one's childhood, indeed one's life, slides off into the past beneath dull grey English skies. Except for holidays and summer outings, for which, of course, that much-loathed garment, the blue-grey Packamack, with its large and rubbery buttons, was indispensable. Some Packamack days enshrined themselves in family folklore. An afternoon on the North Devon coast, when the only options were to stay in the buffeted caravan, playing cards and reading John Buchan, or struggle across a windswept, rain-sheeted seafront to a concrete cinema showing, however improbable it seems to be now, Fred Astaire and Sid Charisse in silk stockings. I'd much have preferred the Buchan option, but I was taken to the film. I was 11. It was 1957. It must have been in the sixth form that rain and joyful delight first began to go consciously hand in hand. No coincidence, I think, that this was also the time when English poetry was handed on to me like a baton in a relay race by an exceptionally gifted teacher. Passionate himself about the canon, whenever the A-level syllabus allowed him a choice, it was the poetry option he went for. Thus we studied Chaucer and Wordsworth, Blake and Donne, Byron, Hopkins and Arnold. As it has a habit of doing, poetry drew out of me much that was there in latency, helping to elucidate my loves. Arnold and Hopkins in particular released me into fertile relationships with landscape and weather, which have so far proved inexhaustible. There's little specifically about rain in either of them, though Hopkins ended one of his bleakest poems with the prayer, "O thou Lord of life, send my roots rain," and his passionate and prescient plea at the end of Inversnaid surely finds its place in every pluviophile's Bible. "What would the world be once bereft of wet and of wildness? Let them be left, oh, let them be left, wildness and wet. Long live the weeds and the wilderness yet." And it's difficult even now, walking in my garden in May or early June, when petals stain the paths and fences, not to imagine that I hear, with Arnold, the cuckoo's parting cry from the wet field, through the vexed garden trees, come with the volleying rain and tossing breeze. And don't I remember one adolescent Sunday, writing for homework about stanzas from the Grand Chartreuse, when inner and outer worlds seemed lingeringly to coalesce. A wet autumnal afternoon darkened into evening around my parents' house as I left behind me alpine meadows soft suffused with rain and rode with Arnold past long disused dark forges, up on his mule track through the dripping woods, towards the great monastery and the comfort and shelter of a finished essay. The pluviophile's Bible, did I say? That's almost literally true in my case. More than simply metaphorical, anyway. For I do have a book, a sacred book, its pages virtual, perhaps, but a book nonetheless. It has the word rain in big letters on the front, and into it have been pasted 40-odd years of clippings, gleanings, etymologies, memories, anecdotes, and the pluvial loot of a dozen ransacked literatures. Here's Pepys, for example, writing in his diary on the 19th of July, 1662. In the afternoon I went upon the river. It raining hard upon the water, I put ashore and sheltered myself, while the king came by in his barge, going down towards the downs to meet the queen. Methought it lessened my esteem of a king that he should not be able to command the rain. How delightfully sly and laconic that is. Written little more than 2 years after the Restoration, it mirrors what must have been continuing uncertainty about the nature and ways of kings. The rain provides not only the vehicle for the joke, but also a perfect setting for it. Pepys stands in the protective isolation of a summer downpour, beneath a great oak perhaps, and reflects on power gliding its urgent way along the Thames. And here, 100 years or so earlier, is an anonymous lover. Western wind, when wilt thou blow? The small rain down can rain. Christ, if my love were in my arms and I in my bed again. This famous lyric probably comes from a part book owned by a musician at the court of Henry VIII. Part of its attraction is that, fragmentary in nature, removed from a larger context, its grammar condensed and elliptical, no one can now be sure precisely what it means, which somehow allows the small rain to assume an almost mystical significance. Are these the light rains and showers of a lover's longed-for spring? Who can tell? It's best simply to experience the poem, to agree with C.S. Lewis that there is almost everything in it, weather, distance, longing, passion, and sober, home-felt reality. Many poets, not contemptible, have said less in far longer pieces. A poem some 400 years younger, and linked to that Tudor quatrain by two simple words, has some of the same inexplicable beauty. In E.E. Cummings' Somewhere I Have Never Travelled, Gladly Beyond, a lover addresses the final compelling otherness of his mistress, the effortless power of her very fragility. His being opens and closes at her glance as a rose is touched by spring, its mildnesses or snows. He does not understand her accomplishment of this, but nobody, as he says in the poem's wonderful personifying last line, nobody, not even the rain, has such small hands. Not all the rain's appearances in our poetry are so gentle. It has many and various moods. Consider Edith Sitwell's remarkable Still Falls the Rain, in which it is put to the most terrible of employments. Written in the Blitz, the poem's raindrops are at one and the same time falling bombs, Christ's blood, and all the wounds and sorrows of the world. Still falls the rain. Dark as the world of man, black as our loss, blind as the 1940 nails upon the cross, still falls the rain, with a sound like the pulse of the heart that is changed to the hammer beat in the potter's field, and the sound of the impious feet on the tomb, still falls the rain. It is best not to linger here. Let us turn instead to the busy depiction of an early 18th century London street. Jonathan Swift regarded A City Shower as the best thing he ever wrote. Some of the scenes and incidents from which it is built are familiar today. Washing is whipped briskly from the line, the shops fill with bedraggled women pretending an intent to buy, but actually seeking shelter. The most disparate people are driven to take refuge together. Whigs and Tories stand side by side beneath an awning in a coalition of the rained upon. Other details are now thankfully foreign to us. From all parts of the town, rubbish is borne along the swelling kennels or gutters. Distinctive suites of filth reveal which streets they originated in. From west of Smithfield, falling down to the Fleet, come sweepings from butchers' stalls, dung, guts and blood, drowned puppies, stinking sprats, all drenched in mud. Dead cats and turnip tops come tumbling down the flood. On the basis of this passage, as well as because his is the earliest recorded use of the phrase, Swift has been credited with inventing the idiom raining cats and dogs. Unfortunately for this argument, London skies were raining dogs and polecats almost a century earlier. Idiomatic expressions for heavy rain occur in most languages. Stair rods plummet from the skies in England, while broken clay pipe stems characterise the Netherlandish downpour. By far the commonest kinds of idiom globally, a variance on a single ponderous observation. It's raining as if it's being poured out of a basin, bowl, tub, watering can, or, most commonly, bucket. Also widespread and surprisingly are those various entities which choose to urinate upon us. Impersonally, as far as we Brits are concerned, but quite specifically bovine if you're French. Strangely, what the Cantonese speaker imagines anointing him from heaven isn't urine, but in the delicate words of my source, dog poo. I think I may be missing something here. Infinitely preferable to my mind is Mandarin's exotic and somehow joyfully precise basin-bending big rain. Basins constructed from stitched banana leaves? I like to think so. Two groups of idioms particularly fascinate me. Why should heavy precipitation suggest to both Danes and Germans that it's raining shoemaker's apprentices or cobbler boys? Or to the Irish speaker, that cobbler's knives are being thrown around. Presumably, master cobblers are far too responsible for such pranks, so it's those pesky apprentices again. Even more incongruously, perhaps, why should Welsh and Afrikaans each choose old ladies with sticks or knobkerries to wet them to the skin? They seem like the rags and scraps of an ancient mythology, perhaps the same one which even to this day makes female trolls hurtle down upon Norwegians. The impetus behind most of these expressions seems relatively simple, though, and the metaphors fall into two broad groups. The first employs heavy objects of various kinds to express the sheer weight of falling water. Thus the Catalan is battered by boats and barrels while it rains tractors upon the Slovak, but wheelbarrows on the Czech. No wonder those last two peoples went their separate ways. The second, very obviously, makes use of long, thin, straight or sharply pointed objects. An 1820 cartoon by George Cruikshank wittily combines cats and dogs with pitchforks to suggest that his Jane Austen maidens and parsons, hurrying with ruined umbrellas through the town, are stricken by rain that is both heavy and stingingly cold. Dialect, too, has important contributions to make to the business of getting soaked. Over much of my own north of England, educated standard speech is enriched by the verb to sile, usually met with in the form siling down. As a teacher in the early 1970s, I remember a colleague, a Londoner, coming across it for the first time in a pupil's work. Partly out of genuine interest, partly for pedagogic reasons, he asked precisely what kind of rain this was. The boy gave it some thought. "It's the kind that comes straight down, sir, and then bounces back off the pavement." How right he was. A follow-up trip to the Oxford English Dictionary showed that the word derives from an old Norwegian verb sila, which meant to strain, especially milk fresh from the cow. It's a particularly rural and domestic word somehow, but one that has made itself indispensable, successfully moving very far with the times. All across the old Danelaw, we unwittingly celebrate the longhouses and byres of our Viking linguistic heritage every time we stand in the doorway and watch this kind of downpour. Another favourite word, one enjoying high status in my personal pluvial lexicon, is petrichor, the distinctive scent released when rain falls upon dry ground. Compounded of the Greek words petros, stone, and ichor, the thin and tenuous fluid which ran in the veins of the gods, it was first coined in 1964 by Australian geologists I.J. Baer and R.G. Thomas. Writing in Nature, they showed how oils secreted by certain plants are absorbed by clay-based soils and rocks, only to be released again when it rains. I probably oversimplify the science, but what matter? Something that needed a name has been named, and beautifully, and long may Messrs. Baer and Thomas be honoured for it. We may surely be grateful that they didn't stick with their earlier intention and call it argillaceous odour. Grateful too that ichor, which in modern times had come to mean only a watery discharge from a wound, now flows through divine veins again. The poet Jenny Ratz, who first introduced me to the word nearly 20 years ago, imagines the sun as an alchemist at a work of distillation. From seed pod oils and waxes, from juniper berries and pine trees, we know, she says, when this canopy of plant volatiles is released by the blue haze that lifts our summer countryside. When it first rains on parched surfaces of the earth, we breathe in a scent reminiscent of geranium leaves called petrichor. This tenuous essence of stone, vapour of plant life, is absorbed by clay or rock and waits to be revived by rain falling on dry ground. As do we all, which makes it an appropriate point at which to bring to a close this pluvial celebration, these words about rain. By the time you hear them, the heavens may have opened again. Today, as I write them, I can at least look forward to getting wet.
Our interval talk was written and presented by Peter Didsbury and produced in Bristol by Sarah Langan. Welcome back live to the Royal Albert Hall, where the Czech Philharmonic and conductor John Elliott Gardiner are giving this Sunday night prom. Janáček and Dvořák, the Eighth Symphony, to come in the final part of the programme. But next we're going to hear Grieg's Piano Concerto. Grieg himself gave the first performance in Copenhagen in 1869, and the work was an immediate success. For the remaining four decades of his life, people around the world wanted Grieg to play the work. The constant demands, in his view, something of an obstruction to his life as a composer. Grieg was 25 when he wrote the concerto, on holiday with his wife and two-month-old baby daughter in Denmark. It was a happy time, which led to a burst of creative energy. He was a composer who suffered from frequent periods of bleak depression, during which he was unable to work. This wasn't one of those moments. Well, tonight the concerto is going to be played by the German pianist Lars Vogt, who I met up with this afternoon. We began by discussing the influences on the work. Schumann's piano concerto inspired Grieg, but there are other musical models at play. Lars hears the sound of another great composer in the finale.
I think he had Chopin's first piano concerto possibly in mind with this left-hand rhythm, this rum bum rum bum. You know, it's a bit like in the Chopin bar, yum bum bum da da dum, and even sort of a triplety side thought that he has there is also a bit like in the Chopin concerto.
It's an extraordinarily accomplished piece, isn't it? Particularly when you think that he hadn't had that much experience of writing on this scale.
I've been playing it for quite a long time now, nearly 20 years, and it's just always stays fresh. I always enjoy playing it. It always moves me. And I think the key thing to that is simply that it's genuine music, where it's not somebody who, you know, just wanted to write some cheap effects down or so, but who really felt strongly about these colors and these tunes and all that.
And do you get a sense of Grieg's personality, of the open nature of Norway, of his nationalism, of the fields and the forests and the great wide spaces?
Definitely nature plays a big part in it. Nature on the outside, but probably also nature on the inside. And the way of sort of finding your private space of, well, it sounds cliche, but the private little space of dreaming and finding and connecting to your own nature inside. That's, for example, in the second movement, It's just so lovely where when the piano enters, hardly anything happens, really. It's just sort of like a dream fantasy about the tonality that he's in. And I find that really, really lovely and still always refreshing. It is great to listen to, even if you've never heard it. I think it will speak to you really immediately. But it also stays fresh and stays alive when you've heard it and played it many times, I think. And that really speaks for the quality.
The German pianist Lars Vogt, who we'll hear very shortly playing Grieg's Piano Concerto. Fantastic picture in tonight's programme, one that you will know well, of another great pianist playing Grieg, Eric Morecambe, with Ernie Wise in that famous sketch on Morecambe and Wise. It was back in 1971, can you believe it, that André Previn came on and showed them how to do Grieg properly. If you want to look at that picture, indeed look at all of tonight's programme, available online at bbc.co.uk/proms. Well, the Adagio, the second movement of this piano concerto, sees the piano rather ignore the opening theme and pursue its own course. The finale starts with a theme based on a Norwegian dance, the Halling. So here is Lars Vogt, with him John Elliott Gardner, to join the Czech Philharmonic in tonight's performance of Grieg's Piano Concerto. A great hug between Sir John Eliot Gardner and Lars Vogt after that performance of Grieg's Piano Concerto in A minor with the Czech Philharmonic Orchestra. With that great orchestral flourish at the end, Grieg brought his large-scale orchestral ambitions to an end. After the concerto, he spent the rest of his life composing works on a much smaller scale. Songs, he wrote around 180 of them, and his magical lyric pieces, of which he composed over 60. Grieg died a national hero just over a century ago in 1907. Norway's most important composer. He was the first Scandinavian composer to find international acclaim. His influence felt by Debussy, Sibelius, and many other composers besides. He visited London several times, met Henry Wood, who in his autobiography recalled, "We were all so taken with this shy, refined, delicate little man whose wife spoke such excellent English." Lars Vogt and John Eliot Gardner back on the platform, bringing solo members and now the entire Czech Philharmonic to its feet. Twenty years ago that Lars Vogt won second prize at the Leeds Piano Competition, an event that placed him firmly on the international stage. This season he's appeared with the Berlin and Vienna Philharmonic Orchestras, the Mahler Chamber Orchestra as well. Stamping, slow hand clapping to urge him back once again onto the platform, and here he comes. Lars Vogt alone this time. And he's sitting down at the piano.
Thank you very much. A nocturne by Frédéric Chopin. Thank you.
A Chopin Nocturne, played by Lars Vogt, C minor, opus posthumus. C sharp minor, I beg your pardon. One of those wonderful Brahms moments when complete silence. The audience from the arena up to the heights of the gallery. Listen to the sound of solo piano. Lars Vogt from Germany, but lives in the UK now. And he'll be back at the Proms tomorrow to give a chamber prom at the Cadogan Hall. That's at 1 o'clock tomorrow. Janacek's In the Mists and Schubert's Piano Sonata in G. 1 o'clock tomorrow lunchtime, live here on BBC Radio 3. He also runs a festival near where he comes from in Germany called Voltage. Its name comes from the fact that it takes place in a hydroelectric power station on the edge of a German lake. For a week each year, they switch off the generators, turn the place over to music. Well, we come to the second interval now in the Sunday night prom. Two more Czech works ahead, Dvořák's Eighth Symphony, and before it, the Ballad of Blanik by Janáček, a great piece of Czech patriotism. First of all, we return to the Proms Literary Festival, a discussion recorded just before tonight's concert across the road at the Royal College of Music. We join Rana Mitter.
Hello, and welcome to the Royal College of Music. More than 70 years ago, a British Prime Minister claimed that the Czechs were a far-off people of whom we know nothing. But these days, Prague is just over an hour's flight away, and Czech genius is even closer, just across the road at the Albert Hall, with tonight's programme of Czech music. While Sir John Eliot Gardner will be tackling Martinu, Dvořák and Janáček, we're grappling with the prose stylists of Prague and the bards of Brno. Over the century, world literature has been graced by the most rhapsodic of bohemians, from Hašek's tales of the peripatetic soldier Schweik to Kundera's reflections on being and its unbearable lightness. But what makes this literature so special? Joining me today are Rajendra Chitnis, senior lecturer on Czech literature at Bristol University, and the novelist James Hawes, who has a passionate interest in one of Czech writing's key figures. And to read for us, we have a brilliant actress, known for her roles from Ophelia at the National Theatre to Beatrice in The House of Eliot, Stella Gone. Would you please welcome my guests? Well, let's start with a reading from a writer who's one of Prague's most famous sons, but didn't write in Czech. Metamorphosis by Franz Kafka. Stella?
When Gregor Samsa awoke one morning from troubled dreams, he found himself changed into a monstrous cockroach in his bed. He lay on his tough, armoured back, and raising his head a little, managed to see, sectioned off by little crescent-shaped ridges into segments, the expanse of his arched brown belly, atop which the coverlet perched, poised, ready to slip entirely off. His numerous legs, pathetically frail by contrast to the rest of him, waved feebly before his eyes. What's happened to me? He thought. It was no dream. His room, a proper, if slightly too small, human room, lay still between the four familiar walls, over the table on which an unpacked array of cloth samples was spread out. Samsa was a travelling salesman, hung the picture he had only recently clipped from a magazine and set in an attractive gilt frame. It showed a lady equipped with a fur hat and fur stole, sitting upright and holding up to the viewer a heavy fur muff into which the whole of her forearm disappeared. From there, Gregor's gaze directed itself towards the window and the drab weather outside. Raindrops could be heard plinking against the tin window ledges, made him quite melancholy. What if I went back to sleep for a while and forget about all this nonsense, he thought. But that proved quite impossible, because he was accustomed to sleeping on his right side, and in his present state, he was unable to find that position. However vigorously he flung himself to his right, he kept rocking onto his back. He must have tried it 100 times, closing his eyes so as not to have to watch his wriggling legs, and only stopped when he started to feel a light, dull pain in his side, unlike anything he had ever felt before. Oh, God, he thought, of all the stressful jobs to go and choose on the road, day in, day out.
Thank you, Stella. The opening there of Kafka's story Metamorphosis, translated, of course, from the German, one of the most famous passages in 20th century fiction and a product of Prague. Now, James, you've written a book, Excavating Kafka, in which you've shattered some of my deepest illusions. I assume that Kafka is this terribly gloomy guy who sums up this sort of Czech Central European gloom and torment. And yet, actually, this passage seems to be, in some ways, a much more kind of macabre, surreal type of humour. Now, is that the reason that perhaps we should think of Kafka as a Czech rather than a German writer?
Well, certainly, we have to locate him, I think, in a world which is almost impossible for us to reimagine. And this is this world of German-speaking and, in Kafka's case, Czech-speaking Central European Jewry before the Holocaust was even a twinkling in someone's ghastly eye. For obvious reasons, the Holocaust, it's almost impossible to reimagine that world, but Kafka was part of that. And unless we can stop reading him in the context of that darkest of mirrors, we're never going to understand the humour, which is absolutely central, as Stella brilliantly brought out there, I thought, also with the trial. It's on record that when Kafka first read the trial to Max Brod and his other friends, they all, including Kafka, fell about with laughter. A reaction which would be rather rare today, but that's what we've got to try and get back to.
So maybe we need to rediscover the slapstick in Kafka. But could I just go with that idea which I think you alluded to there of division? I mean, maybe this is something that, again, is distinctive about the Czech writing and Czech culture rather than the other nations of Central and Eastern Europe, Catholic versus Protestant, Slav versus German. Is that something, that, again, that gives a very special Czech flavour to the writing?
There is. I mean, the notion that the Czech lands, whatever you want to call them, lie on this sort of fault line of European history is not simply waffle. For example, Bohemia, as it was then called, is the very place where in 1903 this thing called the German Workers' Party is founded, later to become the National Socialist German Workers' Party. Well before the First World War, it's the first place where racial divisions invade the social democrat notion of workers altogether and so forth. It is one of the fulcrums of European history, again and again, you know.
Now, Rajendra, of course, you're a specialist in Czech language, Czech literature. To put it very bluntly, do you have to be writing in Czech to count as Czech?
I think that the burden on the Czech writer, certainly since the 19th century, has been in writing in Czech, is serving the nation by showing the language at its best. And it's led to a great focus on how writers write, how writers use the language, which is a very important part of
Czech. But what about this multicultural story that Jane's been alluding to here, which has, you know, this crossing, this transnational element with different languages all being part of a Czech culture?
It is interesting to look at the context of Bohemia at the time of Kafka, and I'm sure important too. But I think at the same time, Kafka clearly is looking back in German literary history, in a German literary context most of all. And I think his influence on Czech literature has been the same as his influence on other European literatures. It's not as a sort of... And I think, you know, the Prague Tourist Board takes a different view of this, but I think that, you know, they've tried to make him more of a sort of Czech son than perhaps he was at the time.
Absolutely. I mean, they're wonderful, and in from our point of view, tragic moments, really, from the early 20s, particularly when Kafka's first cousin, Bruno Kafka, who was one of the leaders of all the German speakers in then Bohemia, became a member of the new Czechoslovak parliament, and repeatedly made speeches in German in the parliament, which was perfectly allowed under Masaryk's constitution. And one of them, one of which, in tragic comedy, is a plea to the German officer members of the new Czech army to stop speaking German in public when they're drinking, because it gives the wrong impression.
I mean, there is something I just want to pursue a bit more here, Rajendra, because on the one hand, one understands, not just with Czech literature, but certainly with the Czech literature, that writing is part of the creation of a sense of national identity, and it's very important. But there is also a danger of a sort of exclusionism, which, of course, in European history has led in some rather disturbing directions, perhaps not necessarily in the Czech Republic, but elsewhere in the wider region. Isn't the linguistic barrier, putting a kind of hard boundary around it, potentially rather a dangerous way to define the literature?
I think the thing that occurs to me is that the Czechs want two possibly contradictory things from their literature and indeed from their culture generally. I was thinking, I mean, since we're talking about music, that when Janáček writes about Smetana, who was the sort of father of modern Czech music, the first thing he says is that he's very Czech, that he couldn't be more Czech, that it's the interest in nature, the interest in the everyday. This is what makes him Czech, his ability to evoke medieval history. But then the next thing he says is that he is an international composer who knows lots about Wagner and Liszt. And so, you have these two things that have to be combined.
Do any traces of this turmoil or this set of both hidden and explicit questions about the nature of Czech literature reflect themselves in contemporary Czech writing?
Yes, I think they do in different ways. I mean, the very obvious example, which I'm sure is on people's minds, is Milan Kundera, who, of course, wrote in Czech for a long time, but emigrated to France in 1975, and his last three novels have been written in French, and the Czechs have an interesting view of him. The Unbearable Lightness of Being was not published for a long time in Czechoslovakia and the Czech Republic, and when it was, in about 2006, the reception was surprisingly positive, because the view of Kundera before that had been rather negative. He'd left, he'd gone away and stopped writing in Czech.
And I think we're also going to hear in a moment about a particular contemporary Czech writer, Daniela Hordrova, who reflects some of these conflicts in her own writing.
Yes, she does. I mean, she's another Prague writer. She's clearly influenced by Kafka. She writes about a German Jewish Prague that is intermingling, that she experiences as a child. Yeah, and this is very much, her interest, I think, is to break free of this very fixed national view of things.
Well, let's hear how she does that with an extract from Daniela Hodrova's novel, Theta. Stella.
Eliška Barankova is standing in the slowly moving snake of those receiving the chocolate host from the fingers of Comrade Midas. Behind her stands Pavel Fink, and she can feel his hot breath on her neck. They are moving in small steps, baby steps, as they used to say in a game she played in the playground of her childhood. Suddenly, her head starts spinning. Is it from anticipation of that unbelievable sweetness, or from the breath of Pavel Fink, her first love? The closer Eliška comes to Comrade Midas, behind whose grey jacketed back brightly shines the red scarf of Mr. Holm, the more overpowering her dizziness. Eliška Barankova? She comes too in a trolley bus on a red leather seat. Above her, she can see kind eyes and reads anxiety in them. The corner of the scarf is tickling her face. Mr. Holm, who after all is a magician, takes an orange from his pocket, peels the tropical fruit and places the bloody segments in her mouth. Eliška Barankova feels that she is committing treason by receiving the blood of Mr. Horn and not the body of Comrade Midas. She is becoming from that moment the follower of another cult, one that is forbidden, pagan. And the next time Midas's chocolate chestnut is dissolving on her tongue, she will long for Hon's bloody apple.
Thank you, Stella. I mean, in that extract, Jendra, the word treason is used, and that's a pretty strong thing. We get this very strong feeling of a character in whom we feel this shifting and even betrayal of allegiances. Now, is that a theme that is very central to the way in which Czech literature defines itself, grapples with itself today?
Yeah, I mean, I think I find Hodrova very attractive as a writer because of this description of this situation. You spoke before about dividedness, but I think I would use the word intermediacy, which is quite it's a seductive way of looking at Czech
literature. What does that mean, exactly?
To be in the middle of things. And The communion metaphor in the passage that we've just heard is very important because it goes back to the Hussite demand that people should be given communion in both kinds. And Hodrava presents the Czechs as sort of permanently utraquist. They are on both sides at once, or they're in both kinds. And I think this passage, if a Czech of a particular generation were hearing it, would associate it particularly with the idea of a public and private persona under communism, that one sort of appeared in public to be sort of supportive of the regime, even as a child. Comrade Midas, you notice that then Mr. Chaun, who is the sort of private, the secret identity. But I think that Hodrava is going further than that. What I would just want to say is that she is looking at Czech culture as being a place where there is both this very fixed, imposed idea, which people, the collective, accept, whether it's national ideology or something else. She's setting against this sort of idea of existence as something very fluid, very mysterious, very strange. She favours that, of course, but both things exist. So both things are there. So it's the intermediacy.
James, I wonder if you could pick up that idea of being in the middle, because again, both the Czech Republic and Prague specifically, I think you've said, have been a sort of prisoner of their own geography. I mean, the sense of place is very important in defining Czechness, isn't it?
It's tremendously. And I mean, the question, and it's become one of the bugbears of the whole business. I mean, one of the extraordinary things about Kafka, to go back to him, is that one of the little known bits of his life is that there's a hospital which still exists just 2 miles within the present Czech border, which in Kafka's day was rather wonderfully known as Frankenstein, which he founded himself. He was absolutely instrumental in founding, but was only for German-speaking soldiers. So the good soldier Schweik, wouldn't have made the cut. He would simply not have been allowed in through this door. And that notion of where the boundaries are is not at all a theoretical problem, for obvious reasons, even in modern Czech Republic.
But there's also something with this character who've just heard about in the reading, Eliška, and also Gregor Samsa, who we started with. They both seem to have a sense of sort of victimology about them. Would that be fair?
A sense of being
put upon. I mean, this seems. I'm just wondering if that's something that maybe comes again from the tyranny of position, of geography.
Well, certainly, if Brecht's right to say that happy is the land that needs no heroes, I mean, the Czechs have been extremely unlucky in that they've consistently needed heroes, many of them tragic, failed, and executed throughout their history. And I think that's. I mean, how can one not feel that when one walks the streets of Prague, being aware as one is of the extreme. The ambivalence history involved in, for example, the buildings one looks at, which, of course, the majority were, if one's rather tactless about it, built by Germans.
I wonder if that idea of coexistence, also having two ideas, two halves that come together in one person, or perhaps even one nation, is a good moment for us to introduce the next passage, which features both a Czech victim and a Czech oppressor, and it's from The Cremator by Ladislav Fuchs. Stella.
"This is Mr. Ernst Wagner," said Mr. Kopfer Kingel to the boy, who was trembling like a lamb and desperately squeezing his hand. "SS Sturmbannführer. He loved his nation and music. He will be buried to the sound of Wagner's Parsifal." Mr. Kopfer Kingel smiled sadly at his terrified son. "Look. This Mr. Wagner is a thoroughbred German, not a soft, effeminate soul, but a man of pure blood. Every member of the SS, regardless of rank, must prove his lineage when he wants to get engaged or married. Laws are here to help people." Mr. Kopfer Kingel smiled and then said, "He has a proper coffin, nice and deep, and wide. How would it be if you were to lie down next to him, Mili? Lie down next to him, and on Monday be melted down with him to the sound of Parsifal." And with a smile, with a less than jolly smile, he took the iron bar that was lying in the corner near the recess with a curtain, threw the boy on his knees, and straddling him in his high black boots and tilted hat with the string and feather, he beat him to death with the bar. Then he lifted him from the ground and pushed him into the coffin with the SS man. It was a proper coffin, nice and deep and wide. They fitted in together like two stepbrothers. He hammered the coffin shut with pliers, checked that the bar and floor slabs were clean, adjusted his hat, and left.
Thank you, Stella. An extract there from a very disturbing novel, blackly comic perhaps, The Cremator by Ladislav Fuchs, which was first published in 1967. I mean, what is it that we should be extracting about the Czech nation from this?
Well, the novel is about a Czech man who loves his family, who also he works in a crematorium. He thinks that the crematorium is the ideal place because it functions to a timetable and everything. The way of getting rid of the bodies is putting them back into the universe, as it were. And he believes he's doing a kind thing. He's persuaded by a Sudeten German that he has German blood. He's reminded of his wife's Jewish origins, and he begins to see degeneration in his children, and he thinks he's doing a kind thing.
But Jinder, could I ask you a wide question and ask for a concise answer, which is not very fair, but... Tonight we're going to hear Dvořák, Janáček, Martinů, a whole variety of great Czech artists. We've been hearing about Kafka, we've been hearing about Fuchs from the Cold War, and Hodrova, a much more contemporary author. Is there some way in which we can find a commonality between these various cultural artifacts, these cultural products?
I would say that you have something which can be seen as quite conventional, quite even banal, quite straightforward, and then looked at in another way becomes something quite radical, experimental, subversive, and the two things are there, and we need to think about both of them.
That's a very Hussite, if I may say,
yes,
so, doesn't it?
It is.
A great discussion, but I'm afraid now we have to check out from this event. So... thank you all very much for joining us this evening, and thank you to my guests, Rajendra Chitnis, James Hawes, and Stella Gonne.
Tonight's Proms Literary Festival discussion was presented by Rana Mitter, and the producer was Zahid Wally. Well, welcome back this Sunday night, live here at the Royal Albert Hall, the BBC Proms. It's 24 minutes to nine this Sunday. This is part three of our extended prom. Petrok Trelawney with you here on BBC Radio 3. I forgot to mention earlier on, great scenes downstairs. Lars Vogt is in dressing room 2, which he's sharing rather wonderfully with Basil Brush. There's a great sign on the door, Lars Vogt's name at the top, Basil Brush underneath. Basil Brush will be joining with Louise Fryer to co-host tomorrow morning's Children's Prom, live on Radio 3 at 11 o'clock. Well, as the Prommers do their nightly charity chant, looking slightly bemused, I have to say, the players of the Czech Philharmonic are coming back onto the platform to take their positions. Dvořák's 8th Symphony ahead this evening, before it a short work by Janáček, the Ballad of Blanik. Now, the Czech Philharmonic isn't a particularly international orchestra in terms of personnel. Most of its players are Czech. Earlier, I asked John Elliott Gardner how that affected the performance we're hearing tonight.
There's very few Eastern European orchestras that have held on to their particular characteristic sound, and the Czech Philharmonic really has. It's distinctive. I've been working with them for about 13, 14 years now, and it takes a while to acclimatise, but once you're in it, it's immensely endearing and immensely attractive, actually, for all Czech music, from the early 19th century music right the way through to Martinů, Janáček and beyond. And they stay faithful to that sound. One has to work at it, one has to bring it to the foreground, into the foreground, because otherwise they think they should sound international. But I love this local dialect, in a way, of sonorities.
Am I right in thinking you discussed this programme with Sir Charles McCarris?
I did. I mean, Charles was a very good friend and a mentor to me all through my career. He and I have been sort of in communication and correspondence in a very collegial way. He was the most wonderfully collegial conductor. Most conductors aren't particularly collegial, but he was. And every time I've done a Janáček opera, I've done 3 so far, he would say, come round, I'll give you a driving lesson on Katya Kabanova or The Cunning Little Vixen or Yanufa. And he was always very generous with his learning and his whole research, putting it at the disposal of somebody younger than him, and I owe him a huge debt for that.
We're going to hear Janáček next, the ballad of Blanik, a great patriotic outpouring of a man who was absolutely a paid-up nationalist.
Absolutely, he certainly was. It's funny, when I told the orchestra the story, they say, of course we know the story, but we never play the piece. So the great dramatic moment when the mountain splits open, the sacred mountain, and the sleeping knights with their swords are discovered to have been turned into plowshares, that doesn't come through very clearly in the music. What does come through is Gili, the folk hero, his going for a walk on Good Friday, his going to the mountain, his approach to the mountain, his amazement at the mystic atmosphere within the mountain, and the great Wenceslas, who's there living in the mountain. And you feel, because Janáček is such a good narrative composer, you can tell the inflections of the story and the little kinks, and it's very graphic.
Well, the Blanik Mountains lie between Brno and Prague. There it was that St. Wenceslas's knights was sleeping, but rose to defeat threatening invaders. John Elliott Gardner taking his position on the platform to conduct the Czech Philharmonic in the Ballad of Blanik by Janáček. Ballad of Blanik by Janáček, John Elliott Gardiner conducting the Czech Philharmonic. Written in 1919, when dreams of Czech independence became reality after the collapse of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. Well, the final work tonight takes us back to the man who conducted the first ever concert this orchestra gave, Dvořák. We're going to hear his Eighth Symphony, written amid the beauty of Bohemia's woods and fields. The Seventh Symphony had been filled with worries and probings. Now they seem a long way away. This is something much more straightforward and revealing. John Elliott Gardiner.
I think Dvořák 8 is in a way the sort of perfect symphony because it's legible, it's intelligible to the listener. It's very familiar to many people, and yet it has all sorts of little mysteries and magic moments in it. And it's deceptive that it's in G major, because it doesn't even start in G major. And the slow movement has this wonderful evocation of the Eroica slow movement. And the scherzo is this glorious Viennese, or is it Pragian waltz, with a wonderful lilting trio section, and the last movement is superb theme and variations, which his imagination seems to know no bounds at all. He just goes on a trip and takes you with him.
Well, the first performance of the Eighth Symphony took place in Prague in February 1890, quickly followed up by a performance in London a matter of weeks later, both of them under the composer's own baton. John Elliott Gardiner returns to conduct the Czech Philharmonic Orchestra in Dvořák's Symphony No. 8. Thank you.
Thank you.
John Elliott Gardner conducting the Czech Philharmonic Orchestra in Dvořák's Symphony No. 8. Sometimes called the English Symphony as it was first published in this country. As well as that London premiere I mentioned, he also conducted a performance in Cambridge in 1890 when Dvořák was made Doctor of Music. Here, a wonderful picture in the programme of Dvořák receiving his honorary doctorate. You can see it via bbc.co.uk/proms. Written just before he left for America. Described by Gavin Plumley in tonight's programme as being a veritable explosion of ideas. Dvořák said he wanted to write something different from his other symphonies. Woodwind players taking their bow. Now the brass, horns first of all. Thought the work might have been intended as a tribute to Tchaikovsky, who Dvořák had met when he visited Prague. Tchaikovsky had invited Dvořák to go on a concert tour of Russia, and the work was perhaps originally planned for that occasion. But in fact, it was premiered in Prague in the end. John Elliott Gardner shaking hands with Miroslav Vilimec, concertmaster of the Czech Philharmonic. A few new players have crept onto the platform. Don't know if there's any significance to that, but John Elliott Gardner's leaving the stage for now. Orchestra sitting down again. Dressed wonderfully formally in tails and white tie. John Elliott Gardner in what is his now characteristic Nero jacket, complete with green silk trim around the bottom of the sleeves. Here he comes, back on again. This is the third of four Proms appearances. Be back here on the penultimate night of the season when he conducts performance of Monteverdi's Vespers that will fully exploit the spatial possibilities of the Royal Albert Hall. He's back on the rostrum now to take another bow. And the program's not quite over. Thank you. So 3 hours plus of music making from the Czech Philharmonic comes to a conclusion with Dvořák's Slavonic Dance, Opus 46, number one, John Elliott Gardner conducting. The orchestra will be heading back to Prague tomorrow, where their new season at the Rudolfinum opens on September the 8th with a performance of Janáček's Glagolitic Mass, conducted by Eliyahu Inbal. This is the Israeli musician's first season as chief conductor of the Czech Phil. Here at the Royal Albert Hall, it's a triple prom day tomorrow. Two proms here. Nicholas Collin conducting his Aurora Orchestra in the children's prom at 11, co-hosted by Basil Brush and Louise Fryer. And then in the evening at 7, Keith Lockhart making his proms debut with the BBC Concert Orchestra. He's their new principal conductor, and he'll be leading a transatlantic programme, including works by Butterworth, Arnold, Gershwin and Bernstein. And the third prom of the day, well, that takes place at the Cadogan Hall, that recital, Janáček and Schubert by Lars Vogt. If you've just switched on, you missed his Grieg earlier on this evening. It'll be available to listen to for a week on the iPlayer via the Radio 3 website. John Elliott Gardner is back on the platform, clenching his fist, smiling at the audience, acknowledging his orchestra once again, and leader Miroslav Vilimec. With that, we bid you good night from the Royal Albert Hall. Back to Ian Skelly at Broadcasting House.
Petrok, thank you very much. That was Petrok Trelawney at the Royal Albert Hall tonight. And you can hear that prom again a week on Tuesday when it forms our proms repeat in the afternoon. That begins at 2:20. Or if you prefer, as Petrok mentioned, you can hear it via the Radio 3 website, bbc.co.uk/radio3, and then navigate your way to the Listen Again page. And if you'd like to submit your own review of tonight's prom, then you can do so on the BBC Proms website, bbc.co.uk/proms, and there you'll find a button called Share. Well, what of the rest of the evening here on Radio 3? We take a journey into the afterlife tonight in our sequence of words and music. Dante, Milton, Wilfred Owen, Emily Dickinson and Walt Whitman provide the words. Britten, Ives, George Crumb, Scriabin and Copeland provide the music. Words and Music begins at 10:30. And it's followed by an interview with Norma Winston in Jazz Lineup. She'll be talking about a new collaboration with many musicians that's produced an album that features music from as far afield as Mexico and Armenia, and as far into the past as the 13th century with the 13th century troubadour ballad. You can hear how all of those influences come together in Jazz Lineup at 9:45. Next, though, we continue our evening with a consideration of what began as a rather shocking manifesto in a Parisian newspaper and led to the launch of the Italian Futurists, who heavily influenced the wider thinking of 20th century modernism. Our Sunday feature tonight considers Luigi Russolo's The Art of Noises, in which he called, amongst other things, for a complete reappraisal of the classical orchestra so that it includes the sound of the modern world. The Art of Noises is in about 7 minutes' time at 9:45 here on BBC Radio 3.
On Breakfast each morning through the summer prom season, we'll be bringing you the Sir Henry Wood Proms Novelties, pieces of music that Sir Henry Wood introduced to proms audiences for the very first time, going right the way back to the first season in 1895. There are lost gems and works that have become great classics over time. The Henry Wood Novelties in Breakfast on Radio 3 every morning from 7.
Two minutes to 10:00 it is. This is BBC Radio 3, and before our next programme, we'll go back a little further than the start of the proms to hear a little bit of Handel, the Allegro, from his Organ Concerto No. 14 in A Major. It's played here by the Concerto Amsterdam, conducted by Jaap Schroeder, with Daniel Schortzemper at the organ.
Thank you. recorded in Haarlem in the Netherlands. Daniel Chortsemper was the organist with the Concerto Amsterdam, directed by Jaap Schroeder, in that Allegro from Handel's Organ Concerto No. 14 in A. Our composer of the week this week, incidentally, is Johannes Brahms. A week of programmes dedicated to his music begins with a programme called To the Great Joachim. It includes some of the pieces Brahms composed for his great friend, the violinist Joseph Joachim, in mind. And by the looks of it, the programme includes a rather special archive recording of the great man himself. Composer of the Week, normally to be found on Radio 3 at midday, is tomorrow a little earlier because of all of our visits to the proms. You can hear it at 10 o'clock. Well, next tonight on Radio 3, the Sunday feature, which explores the music and sound art of the Italian futurists. Emerging in Italy at the start of the 20th century, the futurists sought to capture the excitement of speed and the industrial age through painting, sculpture, architecture and music. 100 years on from their founding manifesto, Robert Warby explores the art of noises.
Excuse me. Mi scusi signora, cerchiamo il numero 23 di Via Stoppani. 23. Non sa.
23 doesn't seem to exist. This must be very disappointing for you.
Well,
looking for Russolo's studio, it doesn't exist anymore.
Yeah, it is, but you know, all the research that I've done on Russolo is exactly, pretty much epitomized by this kind of incidents. You look for things that are no longer there. You see, when you talk about Russolo specifically, the art of noise, you talk about instrument. Well, where are they? You talk about scores, and they are no longer there either.
This is the main square in front of the magnificent cathedral in Milan. I'm stood next to a large orange and black twisting sculpture that is drawing a crowd fascinated by its look and sound. In the centre, there are a number of large boxes with protruding horns. These are representations of intona rumori, noise intoners, originally made by Luigi Russolo. He was part of an artistic movement known as the Futurists, a brash, bombastic, iconoclastic group who published dozens of manifestos, one of which was entitled The Art of Noises.
Let's walk through a modern capital with our ear more attentive than our eye, and find pleasure distinguishing between the gurgling of water, air and gas inside metallic pipes, the grumblings of mortars that breathe and pulse, the throbbing of valves, the rising and falling of pistons, the screeching of mechanical saws, the jumping of trams on their rails, the cracking of whips. We shall amuse ourselves by ideally orchestrating together the rattle of a store's rolling shutters, banging doors, the hubbub and patter of the crowds, the different rackets of the textile mills, of the printers, of the electrical plants, and of the subways.
Years after its birth, there's been a renewed interest in futurism, with exhibitions, TV programmes and radio documentaries, reassessing the movement. While painting and sculpture has received much attention, its music and sound works have been virtually ignored. There are good reasons for this. The scores and the invented instruments of Luigi Russolo, futurist music's principal innovator, have all been lost, all except one 7-bar fragment. Yet his manifesto, The Art of Noises, has entered the folklore of the avant-garde. John Cage, Edgar Varese, and DJ Spooky are but a few who cite Russolo's importance. I've come to Italy to find out more and to ask, with so little of his work in existence, How have Luigi Russolo's ideas survived? And what did his art of noises sound like? This sounds like modern heavy metal music, doesn't it? This is like Extreme Noise Terror or Napalm Death or something like that, isn't it? It really is.
Il futurismo è un grande movimento antifilosofico e anticulturale di idee, intuiti, stinti, pugni, calci, zappi, vecchiatori.
Futurism was the brainchild of the millionaire poet Filippo Thomas Marinetti. Captivated by the excitement of the machine age, he launched the movement with a front-page article in the French newspaper Le Figaro on the 20th of February 1909. The article took the form of a manifesto.
We intend to sing the love of danger, the habit of energy and fearlessness. We affirm that the world's magnificence has been enriched by a new beauty, the beauty of speed. A racing car whose hood is adorned with great pipes like serpents of explosive breath is more beautiful than the victory of Samothrace. We will destroy the museums, libraries, academies of every kind. It is from Italy that we launch through the world this violently upsetting, incendiary manifesto of ours. With it, today, we establish futurism.
The founder of futurism, the man who pulled the movement together, the man who inspired Russolo and many others, was Filippo Marinetti. Here at the Foundation Stellini is a grand exhibition devoted to the life and work of Marinetti, and I'm joined by its curator, Luigi Sansoni. When Marinetti published his original manifesto in 1909, Luigi, what do you think was his grand vision?
Well, his grand vision was, you know, to change the Italian culture from the roots, from the beginning. Yeah, he really wanted to Italy to be a very modern nation in all fields. Poetry, theater, painting, sculpture, photography, everything. He wanted a radical change in the Italian culture. The Italian culture was very, very tied to the 19th century still. And he wanted to change all this. He wanted Italy to become a modern nation, like England, like France, like Germany.
Vissuta, voluta, creare vivendo, talvolta contraddirsi, affermare, lanciarsi, battersi, resistere, riattaccare, lanciarsi di nuovo, indietreggiare mai, marciare, non marcire.
He was a very good PR man. In a way, that's an art of noise. He's speaking out.
Well, Marinetti had a very loud voice, very deep, very profound. And when he did his declamation, people said that, you know, windows, you know, the glass of the windows or the walls, they trembled.
Questo programma minimo propugnava l'orgoglio italiano, la fiducia illimitata nell'avvenire dell'italiano, la distruzione dell'impero austro-ungarico, l'eroismo quotidiano, l'amore del pericolo.
So here we are downstairs in the foundation, and the wall is covered with futurist manifestos. This is astonishing. I've never actually seen an original.
All of them are original ones, yes. The original.
This is the manifesto for painting?
For painting, yes. Yes. And that's on the music, Manifesto della Musica. Okay. And that's the
manifesto for war.
War, soli genere del mondo, yes. And that's the manifesto on the donna, the woman, the futurist woman.
Would you say that futurism was an art of manifestos? Why did they write so many manifestos?
Well, this was one of the big revolutions of Marinetti, because he wanted fusion to expand all over the world.
And it was important to write manifesto because the manifesto soon after were published in different magazines. For example, when Marinetti wrote a manifesto in 1910 and 1911, after a few weeks, those manifestos were already translated even in Japanese. I mean, it was incredible. If you think at the time, you know, we are talking about hundreds, 100 years, a century ago, we had no radio, no television, no internet. It was amazing how, you know, these manifestos were spread all over the world, you know.
So in what way was Marinetti's personality stamped on the Futurist movement? He edited the other manifestos. He wrote some of them, didn't he? He co-wrote them.
He co-wrote many of the manifestos. The title of this exhibition is Marinetti Equal Futurism, because, you know, Marinetti was the Futurist movement. I have a metaphor, you know, it's Marinetti stands to Futurism like Christ stands to Christianesimo, the Christianity. Yeah. He really was the spirit, he was the heart of Futurism.
That was a fabulous exhibition. It gave me a very clear insight into the personality of Marinetti. And it's astonishing to think that only a year after he published the first manifesto in 1909, he gathered around him all these other artists, all the other futurists, including the first futurist musician.
I loudly summon young musicians to the flag of futurism, which, launched by the poet Marinetti in Le Figaro in Paris, has in a short space of time conquered most of the intellectual centres of the world. We encourage the support and exaltation of everything in music that appears original and revolutionary, and consider as an honour the insults and ironies of moribunds and opportunists. The vegetating schools, conservatories and academies act as snares for youth and art alike. In these hotbeds of impotence, masters and professors perpetuate traditionalism and combat any effort to widen the musical field. The reign of the singer must end.
Mama. While Luigi Russolo may have been the most radical futurist composer, he wasn't the first. The Manifesto of Futurist Musicians was written in 1910 by Francesco Balilla Pratella, an award-winning pupil of the famous Italian composer Mascagni. I'm with Roberto Androni, a composer who teaches a course in futurist music at the Cattolica University here in Milan. Roberto, was Pratella's music as radical as his manifesto suggests?
That's the perfect question, I believe, because that's the discrepancy you can immediately notice, that these words are much more revolutionary than his music actually was. And this is not only about Pratella, but probably also about the other followers of futurism in music, where you can hear a lot of traditional approach, both in form, harmony, melody, rhythm, exactly the opposite of what they were proclaiming.
But Pratella's musical education must have occurred at the end of the 19th century. Can you tell us a little bit about what was happening in Italian music at the end of the 19th century? What was radical for Pratella at the time?
Let's say it was just opera, 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 opera.
So this is why Pratella is so anti-opera.
Absolutely.
Because he was just steeped in it. There was so much of it around.
Everything was sort of a dictatorship of melody.
And bel canto singing.
Bel canto, melody. So he includes in this disgust also the Neapolitan songs. Practically all that made Italy famous.
He was just pushing against all that idea of the sweetness of Italian music.
Absolutely, yes. Everything that was... the tradition for him was cheesy. And sort of sentimental and therefore decadent and culturally ineffective.
Let's hear a piece of his, Lavatore Dro, written in 1915, I believe. It's the earliest surviving recording of futurist music. It's a recording made in 1920.
Mm-hmm.
did sound like a John Williams Harry Potter's